When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Denny Somach. This is The Rock Podcast. And on this episode, it's a new conversation with Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone, also known as The Zombies. They currently have a new album out, Different Game, a new feature documentary entitled Hung Up on a Dream, directed by musician and filmmaker Robert Schwartzman and co-produced by him and Tom Hanks, slated for release later in 2023. And they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2019. Now, I've known and interviewed both of them a few times over the years and have seen them in concert. So this conversation went deep, as we usually do. Especially at the end, we discussed some things that they have not ever been asked previously. So you don't want to miss a moment of this. I'm very happy to present Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone, The Zombies. Obviously, I know your history, big fan. It's amazing to see you back together, having all this success, just phenomenal. You got a new album coming out called Different Game. So we'll start with that. You were going to record this before the pandemic, or when did you record it?
That was the idea. We had a great year in America in playing live, leading up to the point where we were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I thought the band had never sounded so good. And I was really keen to get back and start recording the new album. And we decided we wanted to do it in the way that many, many years ago we would have to, because there were only a few tracks available. So everyone would have to play at the same time always. So it was almost as close to a live experience as you can get in the studio, using all studio facilities. Right. So we deliberately did this, but it meant getting everybody in the studio together. And also, it was very important, I felt this time, that I wanted to, you know, because Chris is not with us, I wanted to, like Odyssey and Oracle, I wanted to be in charge totally of the production. So for better or worse, I wanted my ideas of how my songs should sound coming over on the final record. So that they were the criteria. And we went back and we started, and we loved the first two tracks that we recorded. And we thought we were really on a roll. And then, of course, the pandemic hit with a vengeance. And we went through a two-year period where we couldn't get everybody in the same room all the time. And that was a really important facet of what we wanted to do. So it ground to a halt, and it was very frustrating. But it gave me the space to write the rest of the material on the album, except for one beautiful song that Colin already had that we recorded at the end of the album. So that was the process of recording the album. And we were really knocked out with the final result. I mean, and we've had the most wonderful industry reaction. I know it's not out to the general public yet, but we've had the most wonderful industry reaction to it, with a lot of people saying it's the best thing we've done since Odyssey and Oracle. So that's lovely.
Now, is there a story behind Different Game, the song, the title song?
There is, but it applies to many different scenarios. When I wrote that, it was about a specific story about people that I can't name, really, but it doesn't matter. It's about how, it was a band, actually, but it was about how one of the members in particular blamed the rest of the band for his own insecurities now later on in their career, and how the real reason was that life, when you start out and when you're really young, and the way things develop, is a very different game later on in life. That was the subject material of the song, but it could easily relate to people who are dealing with things in as they've really reached a certain stage in their life that seems so different now to them to when they were young. And life really is a different game when you get older, but it's not that you can't deal with it, But you have to realize and be honest with yourself and realize what is really the problem and not blame other people for things which may be centered around you. That was the story. But it's whatever people want to bring to it, you know, and their own experiences. It really is. I think all songs should be like that. It's about what people bring to the song themselves.
Well, I have an advance, so I don't have the who wrote what song. So
okay.
I'm assuming that, are they all original songs?
Yes, all of them. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, I see you've announced some European dates. Will there be American dates coming up?
Well, definitely there's American dates. Well, while we're here, we're playing at South by Southwest. So we're going to be there for about close on to a week. And then we're going to play dates across the southern states of America. And then we're going on one of these music-themed cruises.
Right.
We played on this one last year, and it was very enjoyable, and it went down very well. And then we go back and we're playing in the UK for the whole of April. So the next few weeks are pretty full on. Strangely enough, we don't play in the UK that often. I don't think we've played for 3 or 4, maybe 5 years. So it'll be interesting to get back to the UK and play. After that, someone was asking me, you know, what's happening in the summer? And I thought, that's enough for me for now. Just the release of the record. We've got a documentary that's being released. It's being premiered at South by Southwest. It's an hour and 45 minutes. It's a history of the Zombies right from the very beginning up until, you know, yesterday. It's a really interesting documentary. And then we've got all these dates as well, so our days are pretty full. But I don't know what happens after the first week in May. I think I'm going to find somewhere very quiet and probably go to sleep for a long time.
So the documentary is finished, or is it still
being? Yes. Yeah, no, it's finished. Yeah.
Absolutely finished.
I was going to tell you, I may have some video and audio from all those shows that you did.
All right.
I know Rick Krim. I haven't spoken to him in years, but if you want to have him contact me, maybe I have some stills
or something
you might want to use, tell him to give me a buzz.
Okay, right. Will do. I mean, the thing is,
he knows how to reach me.
Yeah, it is finished now. The executive producer is Tom Hanks. Right. The director is Robert Schwartzman, who is from the Coppola family. Mm-hmm. And he's done a beautiful job on it, I have to say. It's a very affecting movie.
So I don't know if you've heard this comment, but if you have, fine. If you haven't, I'd like to get your reaction. So somebody said that the Zombies is the best 60s band still touring, which doesn't have Mick Jagger as the front man.
I did see that quote.
Yes. Yes.
Mick is joining us next week. He's gonna join us as a dual frontman.
So, you know,
interesting thought, isn't it? I think we should take that as a great compliment. And Stones are a great band. Yeah, you know? Yeah,
absolutely.
Of course.
Absolutely. So you have such a unique history. I mean, I'm just going to dabble on some of them, but your career is just, you know, well, I don't have to tell you, you know, and I'm sure people have been asking you because you broke up and then you had a hit and then somehow Al Kooper heard it and he championed it and it came out. You have a big hit, and Rod, you're
thank you, Al. Yeah,
yeah. Now, how did Al hear about it? Number one, and number two, did you know him before that?
No, but we knew he was. He'd produced some of my favorite records, and A&R'd and played. You know, he was such an important character around that time, and personality. And without him, the Oddest and Oracle album and Time of the Season would never have been released in America, certainly. He came over because he just joined Columbia as their main A&R man and the hot producer that he was at the time. And he picked up 200 albums in the UK. And out of those 200, he went back and he said, he told Clive Davis the story. He said, this is the only album you have to release. He said, you have to find it. Whoever's got it, I don't know who's got it over here. He said, but you've got to find it and buy it. It doesn't matter how much it costs. And Clive said, well, we own it. he said, but we passed on it because we don't think it's really commercial. Now, that's been the history for us all through our career. Even She's Not There, the record company didn't really think it was commercial. And it became a number one record. And Time of the Season was never considered commercial by Clive Davis. And yet he finally put it out at Al's insistence as the third release. And he wasn't even going to release it because he said, we put two things out and it hasn't been a hit. But Al said, you've got to put it out. And it became a number one. Incidentally, 50 years to the very day that we were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it became, 50 years before that was the date that Cashbox published the chart when it was number one in the whole of America.
So, where were you when you found out it was number one? Because you obviously weren't, Rod, you had your band, but, and Colin, you're probably working on some stuff, but what, did somebody call you and say, hey, by the way, you know, your song is number one in America?
Can I tell you? I know exactly where I was.
Yeah.
I was, the Zombies had broken up by that time, by 18 months. And just before Argent went out on the road, I had some time to fill. And my cousin, Jim Rodford, who was the founder member of Argent with me, was doing some backing just for a few weeks of Gene Pitney. And with Gene Pitney and the Grease Band with Joe Cocker supporting Gene Pitney. And I remember it became number one in America, and I didn't think anyone in the UK had ever heard it. And Joe was in his dressing room, and I walked into Joe Cocker's dressing room in the Grease Band, and I was greeted with Joe going, it's the time of the season. And he sang the whole thing through. And I said, how on earth did you hear that? He said, it's number one in America. That's how I found out it was number one. Unbelievable.
So tell us the story behind the song.
It was the last song that we recorded, Cole, wasn't it?
For the album. Yeah,
for the album. Yeah. And it was written very quickly before the... I was sharing a flat with Chris at the time, with Chris White. And I remember playing it to him and saying, do you know what, Chris? I think this could be a hit. But no one else thought so. I don't think Chris even thought so. And certainly the members of the band didn't think so, but they liked it. So we recorded it. And it was the last one. Cole and I fell out in the studio because Cole was looking at... what was it you were doing, Cole?
Well, I felt very pressured because we only had a very small budget. We were running out of money. This was the last track. And it happens where the mic was set up, I had a big clock right in front of me and then a red light underneath it just to emphasize studio times ticking away, you know, the red light and the clock. And I'd only just heard the song. It was only sort of finished the morning before we recorded in the afternoon. So Rod was coaching me from the control room. We talk a lot about phrasing. And so he would be saying, this phrase is on the beat, or can you push this phrase? And I could see the time was running up.
And I was saying all this in a very kind way.
He was being really supportive, but I was starting to panic. And I started some very forceful language down the microphone, forgetting that the whole band were there and a lot of people from Abbey Road were there. I was still just talking to Rod, and the language just got more and more intense, very, very bad language. And it's always amused me that I'm singing It's the Time of the Season for Loving whilst we were shouting at one another and with very, very bad language. But anyway, we managed to finish it with about 5 seconds to go, I think, in the end. And you've just sort of outlined what happened after that. In the UK, there was no interest in Odyssey and Oracle or the Zombies at all. And so we kind of felt that the band had run its course and everybody decided to move on to other projects. But as we just touched on, Al Cooper bought the album and really, really liked it. And it started a new life because of his interest. And when he talked to Clive Davis and convinced Clive to release it, suddenly our lives were changed forever, really. I think I thought that certainly my life in the music business had finished, because when the band stopped, I didn't have any openings that I could try. I didn't want to leave the music business, but there just weren't any opportunities. And it was... it was incredible to hear that it was starting to climb the charts. I think from my part, I'm not sure I really believed it when people started telling me. I thought they were just being kind. And then eventually you find it is actually a huge hit. And for me, that's in a way started a solo career. I started making records again. And my first album was actually with Rod and Chris White producing me. And it's an album called 1 Year. And there was a huge hit.
Thank you very much.
There was a huge hit in the UK and in Europe. Sadly, it was never a commercial success in America, but it started me off. So it's really, this is all down to time of the season. It started me off as a solo artist, and I recorded and toured as a solo artist for many years before we got back together again in 1999.
So, Rod, is there a story about how the song came together or the lyrics? Is what prompted you to write it?
It was against the background, as you remember, of at the time in 1967, of the Vietnam War and the corresponding peace movement that was on. And the feeling, because people were seeing footage from the Vietnam War that was pretty graphic for the times. And before that, any war reporting had been very sanitized and very much on the side of whoever was broadcasting their nation. But suddenly they were seeing some of the things with napalm and everything that were actually going on television. And the youth of the world were horrified, and they reacted against this. And that's when the Love and Peace movement really got underway against that background. And we couldn't help but be affected by that, because even though we were never naive enough to believe the whole thing, the actual background was very profound, really, in some ways, and you couldn't help but be affected by it. So it was against that, you know, like what's your name, who's your daddy, is he rich like me? What is he rich like me means is not to do with money. It's, is he rich enough to teach you what you need to live, in the sense of the richness of his spirituality or whatever. It was that feeling. And I know it's not terribly plain, but it wasn't meant to be terribly plain. You know, it's people bringing their own thing to it. And it was, in a sense, in some ways, I mean, that was the overriding thing, but it was in some ways a little nod in places to George Gershwin, because we always used to play Summertime throughout our career, right from the beginning. And there's a line in Summertime, it goes, your daddy's rich and your mama's good looking. And it was an amusing for me, in a little in joke, that I was saying hello to George Gershwin with that lyric.
So you got inducted into the Hall of Fame 2019, longest wait ever for a band to get in. Of course, you well deserved it. I don't think there's one other person that got inducted that year that was even born when you were in your heyday.
Yeah, that's quite possible. Yes,
maybe Roxy Music, I don't know.
Yeah.
But tell me what the feeling was when you knew you were going to be inducted.
Oh, it's incredible, because first of all, we had a wonderful, over 300,000 people voted for us in the fan vote, which is a mind-boggling amount of people that are voting for you to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And then eventually our peers, the members of the Rock Hall, voted for us. So, I mean, all artists want their work to be appreciated by their peers, by their fellow musicians. So it was really wonderful that they had noticed and acknowledged our achievements. And in a way, perhaps it validates what we've been doing over the years. So it was an incredible experience. And the actual ceremony of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in front of 17,000 people at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. And it was just wonderful. They were a very, very enthusiastic audience. And to get up there, and we actually performed with the original members of the Zombies, which we don't tour with regularly. And it was a magical evening and something I'll never forget.
So did you, Susanna Hoffs inducted you, had you met her before?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. In fact, she came along earlier on. There was a thing that was made for the fans, really, that said, you know, the fans went in for a competition and they could come and sing a song with us of their choosing out of our catalog at a sound check with us backing them, you know, like, so someone might want to come on and sing "This Will Be Our Year" or something like that. And Susanna and we went through this for a few days, and it was really charming, you know, that happened. And then one day the next person came out and it was Susanna Hoffs, and we said, what are you doing here? and she'd asked if she could be part of this thing, you know, and that was the first time I'd met her.
I think the first time for me. Yeah. And then we did an acoustic show in Los Angeles at another time, very intimate, but quite prestigious venue. And Susanna Hoffs came along then, and she came backstage and had a chat. So we did know her quite well by the time we got to the Rock and Roll.
And she was a huge fan. Yeah. She'd been turned on to us, actually, by Matthew Sweet, who she was making some albums with, some solo things with. And she said that Matthew Sweet said, "You've got to listen to this band and listen to what they've done." And she knew about us, but she hadn't really tuned in. But she did tune into us, and she became actually obsessed with some of our catalogue. And she said at one point that she woke up every single morning and played A Rose for Emily from Odyssey and Oracle every day.
So yeah. You must be finding people all the time who come up and said, you know, you influenced me. Kurt Cobain was a fan, you know, about writing about you in his diaries, right?
Oh, and it's really amazing. And I met Dave Grohl for the first time. He came to, we were on with him, weren't we, Carl, on a festival, but he was on another stage. But as we walked off after our set on our stage, he was standing in the side, and he said, and he said how much he loved us and everything, and that he used to play his album, his album of Odyssey and Oracle to his kids each night before they went to bed. And then he said, he actually said, "This might be my favorite album of all time." And Paul Weller said the same thing to us. Tom Petty. Yeah. It's just been lovely, actually.
And all this started with She's Not There because you won a talent contest, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So, right. She's Not There. Was that based on a blues riff?
It wasn't based on a blues riff, no. But I had to write a song for our recording session coming up. I'd only ever written one song in my life before that. And so I went home, and I knew I only had 2 weeks before our recording session. So I thought, right, I need something, some moment of inspiration. I need something to trigger a song. So I pulled out a John Lee Hooker album, an early blues album by John Lee Hooker. And the first track on the album was called No One Told Me. Now, I emphasize that apart from those few syllables, No One Told Me, four syllables, right? Nothing to do with the melody or what the song was about or the words were anything to do with John, except that those words seemed to trip off my tongue. And I thought, you've got to start somewhere. So I started singing to myself, "Well, no one told me." And then I thought, okay, I'm going to plan this song now. I can start at this point. And I started weaving a story, just a love story, really, about rejection and whatever. But musically, I wanted it to start. I knew very clearly what I wanted to do. I wanted to have a blues scale to inform the melody of the first part in the verse. So that was where the blues influence came. It wasn't John's melody. It was my own melody, and it was quite jazzy in a way, but it was based on a blues scale. And then I wanted the middle section to go through a little chord sequence that I particularly liked. And then I wanted it to build into a climax. And although it started in a minor key, I wanted it to build into a climax that was in a major chord, and so it went, you know, "But she's not there," and then drop down right again into a mood, into the moody blues scale. Yeah, not moody blues, but a moody blues scale. And and then, as always with me, I couldn't help myself playing a sort of slightly jazzy improvised solo in the middle of it, And I always seem to insert that thing, you know, it's a selfish thing to insert that into my songs, because I enjoy doing it so much. And that was the record, really.
And then you had a Tell Her No follows that, correct?
Yeah.
You have two hits in a row. Now, you should have had a third one. How did people get a hold of I Love You?
That's an interesting thought, isn't it? I don't think it honestly struck us as a commercial song.
No.
I don't remember.
Nobody else either said it, did they?
No, I don't remember anyone picking up this. That's one of the tracks that just simply got away, you know. But they did a great version of it. They really did.
Most people don't know that that's a Zombie song.
I know.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was sometimes when we play She's Not There, I know this has happened to you, that we play She's Not There and people think it's a Santana song.
I was just going to ask you about that. What did you think of the Santana's cover?
I absolutely loved it. I really, really loved it. They were one of my favorite bands, Santana, and they hadn't had a hit single for a long time. Right. At that point. They were in a desert singles-wise, and then they got a hit with My Song again, which really gave me a huge lift. I thought it was wonderful. And I actually thought they did an absolutely great job on it. I still think it sounds terrific, actually, that cover.
So I got to ask you this, Rod, and you'll appreciate it because I've actually been there a few times. I know you don't have the music store anymore, do you?
No.
Okay. So when you had it, what famous people came in to buy their instruments there?
Well, I was never in the music store. So I don't really know, except I know that Trevor Horn used to come in and play. I remember that. I remember visiting it one day. I kept my eye on how everything was run in the shop, because I started from the premise of not liking music stores at all. And if I was going to have one or be involved in one, I said, there's a couple of things you have to do. And the most important thing is, if someone comes in with no money but wants to talk to you about music and playing, you've got to let him demo on whatever he wants, because, you know, people fall in love with music. And as a keyboard player, you mustn't just blank him because he's got no money. You know, I remember going to music shops and really not liking the experience. I felt out of place and everything. You've got to make them welcome. And that really paid dividends, because some of those people then became really prominent, you know, players, and they came back then and always used our store. So that was the one thing I remember most about it. But I do remember going in there one day, and Trevor Horn was in there, and it was before he had hit records or anything like that, and playing away, and it was great, actually. But it was a really nice atmosphere in there. And a lot of musicians have since told me that it was their favorite music store, because they loved the creative vibe that was going on all the time there.
I've heard people have mentioned it in interviews over the years to me.
Oh.
I've been around as long as you have interviewing people.
So yeah.
Now, Colin, I know you did some solo albums, and a friend of mine, you work with a friend of mine, Alan Parsons, for the Alan Parsons
Right, program. Absolutely, yes.
Of course, his band Keats, because he took me to the restaurant.
Yes.
But I got to tell you, one of the favorite songs of yours, and I can't remember which album it's on, was that Pete Barden's tune, On the Air. Phenomenal.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You should do it in the Zombies. It's a great song.
It is a really good song, isn't it? Yeah. Pete recorded that as a producer, I think in the 80s or something like that. And then I did a cover of it in a much more recent album. I really like that song. It's a great song. I've done it in my solo shows, but we've never done it in the Zombies. The thing is, with the Zombies, we have such a vast repertoire of songs.
Right.
It's quite difficult to know what songs to put in and what songs to leave out. But I was a big fan of Pete Barden's. He was a fine musician, and he had so much energy. You know, he was just working away all the time, and sadly passed away far too young. He was a great musician and also great fun to be with, a real character.
But strangely enough, he was one of the first musicians we ever met outside of St. Albans.
That's right.
Because our very first gig, when we were semi-pro...
Outside of St. Albans.
Outside of St. Albans. was a place called Kingston Baths, and it was the most horrendous acoustic in the world. There were hardly anybody there, and it was this baths were tiled everywhere, and so it was hugely echoey and unpleasant. And the other band that we shared the gig with was
they were called the Shanes.
The Shanes,
but the drummer was
Mick Fleetwood.
And
Pete Bardens was playing in it. He was the keyboard player, and we loved what they were playing.
Yeah,
didn't we?
They were great. Yeah,
he was a great guy. He played in them, Van Morrison, made some solo records, and passed away 2002, I think, of a brain hemorrhage. So, I knew him pretty well. So tell me, what are some of the things that you'd like to do? I mean, obviously you're touring, you got a new record out. Now that you're been inducted, and you know, what are some of the other things that you'd like to do? Are people coming to you and asking you to do things for soundtracks, for TV? What's going on?
Well, that happens all the time. We get our records, but we don't really get involved in that. We've got other people to do that for us. But I'll tell you what I want to do. I want us to have, for the very first time in the UK, the Zombies have never charted in the album charts ever. And it looks like this new album, because of the interest that has suddenly been generated in the UK, and the pre-sales and everything, it looks like it may well chart in the album charts in the UK, in the national album charts. And if that happens, that would be the first time that we've ever achieved that. And that's the next thing I want to see at this stage. I mean, we're 77 years old and we're an emerging rock band.
Yeah, right. Well, there's still classics. I run the Classic Rock Archives in America.
Yeah.
I'm putting you both in, okay? So let me ask you, have you done a biography? Have you any thoughts about writing something about the story of the Zombies? I know there've been some fan books, but any official biography?
Often, haven't there?
There have been, and I know I've been asked to do a biography.
Yeah, me too.
Two or three times. I'm not sure that I'm really want to do it. If I was to do it, I would do it for my family primarily. I mean, maybe it would be available commercially, but I'd quite like my family to know something about the experiences that we've had on the road and you know, just my life in general.
And what I don't want to do is, which most publishers insist on, is put the lurid rock and roll side of what might have gone on in the beginning, etc. I'm just not interested in that at all. And you know, they think that's a real selling point. They always do that. Not interested. What we have got is this documentary film that's being premiered at South by Southwest, which I think is a beautiful film. And it beautifully tells the story of us right from the beginning, right up until the present day. So that's what I would love my family to see. And I'm sure they will.
So I got to ask you this question. I don't know how many people have asked you, but because it was a long time ago. Tell me about the fake Zombies. This was a tour set up by somebody. They put you on the road as the Zombies, and two of the guys in that band later went on to become two-thirds of ZZ Top.
That's right.
It's true. I mean, when Time of the Season was a huge hit single, the Zombies had ceased to exist. And so there was a vacuum. And the music business hates a vacuum. So they filled the vacuum with phony zombie bands. There were three that I know of. You've just mentioned one of them. And one of the amusing things was that Chris White was in the original bass player in the Zombies, was right in the offices of Rolling Stone. And they got Chris to phone the manager of one of these phony bands and posing as a journalist for Rolling Stone and to ask them what's going on with this band. And the manager said to Chris White that they were trying to honor the life of the lead singer of the Zombies who'd been tragically killed in a motor accident.
I never knew that about.
No, I didn't know it about myself, actually. So I've actually read my epitaph 50 years before. Well, I mean, hopefully it'll be a little bit longer.
Well, in addition to Paul is dead, there's Colin is dead. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can see it in Rolling Stone. It was part of a story in Rolling Stone. So there were three bands that were pretending to be us. And we, to be honest, I don't think we really took much notice because we were busy doing other things. There was another band in the 80s or the 90s, that was an English band pretending to be the Zombies, who were particularly poor, very, very bad. I read one or two reviews about them. That was a little bit worrying. And I did try to stop them. I contacted their manager. I contacted the musicians' union, tried a few things, and they stopped quite suddenly. And I thought, I don't know what I did, or maybe some of the other guys in the band were trying to do things. I didn't know what I'd done, but it had worked. They stopped. And then I heard the full story that they were so appalling that one of the fans that had gone along to watch them had gone round to the dressing room afterwards. And I don't recommend this as a way of doing business. I really don't. But he pulled a gun on them and he said, "You are not the Zombies. You're not going to play anymore. That's it." And that was it. They stopped. As I say, I don't recommend that as a way of doing business, but it was very effective.
Did you ever run into Frank Beard or Dusty Hill?
No.
Would you talk to him about it if you did?
Oh, I wouldn't mind. I always found it amusing.
Yeah.
I really did. I think they were the two people that didn't have beards in right. ZZ Top. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. There's only
even though he was called Frank Beard, he was the one without a beard.
Well, there's only three of them. Two of them did have beards. So.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, as Rod said, I think we thought it is an amusing side story. Really, I hope they had a good time. I hope they got paid, which is more than we ever did.
They did. They got $200 a show. I read the article that Ben Fong Torres wrote. They got $200 a show.
Well, it's more than we got
at the time.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Let's not go into that.
No, we won't go into that.
Well, you see, you got all these stories. You got to put a book together because people, I don't know how many people ask you about this kind of stuff, but I'm one of those guys that likes to dig deep. So yes. I had to get the answer to that. You know. Anyway, listen, I want to thank you. I want to wish you a lot of luck with the new album. I happen to be in Florida, so I'm going to check to see if you're coming around anywhere. I know the ship, is it the Flower Power Tour or one of those?
Yeah, we're doing that.
Yeah.
To the Edge, yeah. So I know you usually play dates before that takes off or when it returns. So I'm going to check the schedule, and if there's something there, I'll definitely come see you. I did see you a couple of times over the years on some package shows and some other places. You always put on a tremendous show. So I want to recommend to everybody, if you get a chance, it's not a nostalgic oldie show.
It's not
old songs, but it's got the energy of a new band.
Yeah, totally. We feel it has.
Yep.
So that's why it's so exciting to still continue the career.
Okay. Well, listen, guys, thanks a lot. Sometime maybe we can do a part two, because we didn't scratch the surface of the history, but I hope you got enough stories out of that, and I want to wish you a lot of luck with the album.
Oh, thank you so much. Lovely to see you again.
Lovely to see you, yeah.
Okay, all the best.
That's my conversation with the Zombies, Rod Argent, and Colin Blunstone. Thanks for listening and being part of the Rock Podcast. Tell your friends. They can hear us. We're available at all the usual places you get your podcasts. And we have a video version on YouTube. You can also sign up to our channel, and you'll be notified when a new episode is released. And of course, it's free, no admission charge, just a lot of rock and roll memories. Now, we have recently begun our third season, so you can check out all the previous episodes we have, like The Doors, Yes, Billy Gibbons, Nancy Wilson of Heart, Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen, Roger Waters, and many others. We feature new interviews as well as classic conversation from my archives. The Rock Podcast is the number one podcast for classic rock, and I thank you. You can find us at the website, therockpodcast.com, and on Facebook. You can also send your comments, let me know what you think. Contact me at hello@therockpodcast.com. I love hearing from you. So till next time, I'm Denny Somach, and that's it for now.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.